recoveries that stick out in your mind?
Oh boy, several of them. One of them was when I was working for Weens, and we went up and got a damaged beaver up above Arctic Village on the ice of the river, the Chandelier, I think it is. Me and one other fellow went up there, one Herman Nelson heater and one motor. And the warmest we saw it was 35 below in the middle of the day. That was in November. Yeah, just about this time, because we spent Thanksgiving at the village. And we had the wing was damaged, the gear was damaged, and we made up a big old plate that we on another beaver wing. Got this figured out, kind of brought up, rounded over leading edge a little bit, real heavy stuff. And then we got up there and we had a drum of gas and put that out, and we Spanish windlass pulled the wing down as far as we could. Then put this plate over the damaged part. Now, yeah, I remember no battery pack drills or anything at this time. We didn't have a generator. And drilled the holes with hand drills.
Just to
screw this big thick aluminum plate down. Then ran cables in. I got some pictures of it here. Ran cables in from the wingtip down to some fittings on the fuselage to help brace it a bit, turnbuckles in it. And jacked it up and got the gear all cabled into place and tied together, and it looked like it's going to work. Everything's fine. But oh, it was cold. It was so cold. The fellow went up with me had never been out of the hangar. He'd never gone out on a bush job. But I knew that he had how to take care of himself in cold weather, and I knew he had good gear and everything, so this is fine. Trouble is, he had tin plates. And Ween's turned us loose in the supermarket, so we had plenty of grub, and we bought steaks, got the best we could. And we're up there cooking up, and the steak froze to the plate while I was standing up eating it. And you had to put a layer of bread down, then put the food on that so it'd be insulated. And then we're done, and it's daylight. We figured, well, we can make it. And we're about direct line, probably only 3 to 5 miles from the village. But I figured, well, hell, we'll taxi down to the village because we didn't have a radio or anything. Tell them we were done. So we got everything loaded up the plane, and it wouldn't move. The skis were froze down. So we jacked the skis up. They were wheel skis, and scraped the bottom of the skis, fooled around some more. And then we're trying to get it to break loose. And about this time, the tail wheel decided to dive itself up into the bulkhead. It was already damaged, but this finished it off. So we jammed some spruce trees back in there to keep it in place. And we taxied that damn airplane down the river in pitch black night. And I didn't realize the river had so many turns in it. And I'm sitting there, and we're driving along, and Errol Hill was my partner's name. Fine guy. And he watching the gauges, and I said, I don't think I have to worry about it overheating, Errol. But he says, well, keep an eye on things. We're going along, and I says, Errol, I know I can fly this thing, but I don't know how the hell we'd find Fort Yukon. We got to keep going. And of course, it wasn't turning too good, and we're going across sandbars and willows, and occasionally it's flying as it came off a sandbar and lands again. And by gosh, we come around the corner, and there's a guy out there waving a gas lantern. Oh boy, we've made it. And we skids to a halt, and everything's fine, and got things unloaded, took the batteries out, went up, stayed at the schoolhouse. The next morning, we walk down to the airplane to figure out what else we got to do, if there's anything we can do. We got a message out on the missionary network to Weens that it was flyable. And I was so disoriented by the time we got there at night, well, late afternoon, it was darker than hell, that as far as I was concerned, we were on the wrong side of the river and the airplane was pointing the wrong direction. I was that disoriented. I didn't know where I was at until I saw that lantern. I was beginning to wonder if we'd ever find this place. The people told us, oh, we heard you start it, and then we heard it quit, and then we heard it start getting dark, and all of a sudden we keep hearing it and hearing it and hearing it. Then we came around with the lights on. They were there waiting for us. It was an interesting trip.
So you flew it?
When the wing pilots came up, Darwin Kellogg came up, and I flew back with him. And The way it's listed for ferry permits, only crew necessary for flight, so pilot and me, because I might have to work on it a bit when we got to Fort Yukon. And okay, that all worked out fine. Tightened up the cables a bit, and away we went. Arrow came in on the mail plane, and he just said, I had a wonderful trip. He says, we stopped all the villages and carried on. He says, it was a lot of fun. He says, you have another dozen trips, I'm going to go with you. And he said, later we were having a couple of drinks, and he says, how come you get me to go on this thing? I've never been out in a bush deal like that before. And I said, well, Arrow, I knew you could take care of yourself in the cold weather, and you had good gear, and you weren't going to get excited about anything. And I figured you could hand prop that airplane if we had to. And he looked at me, and Harold was a Finlander. He looked at me, and he says, you Swedes ain't dumb. Oh, he was quite a guy. God, he wasn't too tall. Maybe 5'8 or so. 5'10 maybe. But he weighed about 250 pounds. He's just a mass of muscle. He was good. Talked about it later. He says, actually, it was kind of fun. I said, you didn't think that in the morning. Freezing out there. Unheated tent on the ice.
How'd the plane end up so far upriver from the village?
He'd come around, and they couldn't get into the village, in front of the village on the ice because of the smoke and everything and fog from the fires. So he elected to go up and land further out and in the clear. And he came in, and the beaver has a selector for the flaps. You know, you put it one way, and then you hand pump them up or down. Well, he came back around, and when he made his passes at the village and couldn't make it, he pumped the flaps up. He came around to land further up, and he hadn't switched. So instead of the flaps going down, they went up, and it just fell out of the sky, upright. One wing bent all to hell, and the landing gear spread out. Didn't hit the prop or anything, though. It was all right that way. Oh, yeah, quite a trip.
Are there still people going out and doing these kind of repairs?
Not so much anymore. The helicopters have improved so good that, you know, instead of going out there and spending a bunch of time and carrying on and this and that and hoping to get it fixed, and there's not too many guys who want to do it anymore either or know how. So they just hire the helicopter, go get it. There's an outfit down in Palmer. They got a great big old surplus thing, chopper, and you tell them where everything is and give them the coordinates. They come roaring up, pick up the airplane and bring it into here or wherever and set it down, and they're gone again. Don't know what they charge, but it's just the way it works now. They came in here one year with one and dropped it off, and I'm helping them get the stuff off the wings. Nets and stuff to keep it from trying to fly underneath the chopper. And the mechanic there, he says, I asked him how many they'd picked up, and he says, well, he didn't know about this year because he'd just gone to work for him. But the year before, they'd picked up 30. This place, these guys are based in Palmer, I think it is. Yeah. So you can see how things have changed. Previously, the helicopters were small, and you had to disassemble, and half the time they'd drop them and completely destroy things. So I had to use them once or twice later on, and never did like it. It was just, if there was a way to get it out in one piece, I'd do it. And the last one was, well, there were several others in between. The last one was blogger Sandy Jameson, the artist, way up in the Colleen River. And the helicopter out in the landing gear had broken. Of course, it got the prop and wingtip and everything. And the helicopter people wanted something like $13,000 to get it to Fort Yukon because of the distances involved. This was a smaller chopper. This was, what, 15 years ago or so. I had just moved over here. So I rigged up a bunch of stuff and went up there and got it back together, and that's about the last one I've done. And there was an odd one there. To fix the wing, it wasn't bent too bad, but the leading edge is all cratered up. And for leading edge material to repair it, the best thing is stovepipe. It's partially formed, and you just cut off the corrugated part and form it in the rest of the way. And there's a picture of me with a spruce, chunk of spruce tree, and I'm hammering, trying to get some ribs straightened out a little bit so they get a little structure straightened out. And my wife at that time sent that picture to a relative in Germany. That damn picture must have got all over Europe. This nut, and they're beating with a big hammer down on the side of this wing. Oh, it was funny. Sandy was amazed. He says, that was something. And that was only there a couple days. Colleen River is beautiful country. Way up the upper end. Nice river. Moose, caribou running around. It was neat. It was a good trip.
What time of year was it?
Fall hunting season. He was up Hall of Hunters. He guides too. Sandy's pretty much an all-around guy. Artist, and painter, and carpenter, and I don't know what all else. Something else.
I was a little curious. I mean, now people go to, like, they want to be an airplane mechanic, they go down here to Hutch and they take the AMP courses. What was involved in your training? Did you just work for so long?
Well, the rules are that you can go to an approved school, and most of them are 2 year. The Hutch program is still 1 year. The Northrop program I went to was 1 year, but that was so far back, you see, it was a little different again. Things were a bit simpler. Or you can work for 36 months, get letters written that you've done all this and that, and then go take your orals and written tests and your practicals and get your license.
I guess the more of my question was, back when you were learning to become an airplane mechanic, what was involved in the formal training that you had to go through?
Well, it was a bit over a year, and they just went in segments. There was some for covering and engines and welding and electrical and everything else it takes. And there's about five or six trades all involved in just fixing a small airplane. And there's a curriculum built up by the FAA. The one over at Hutch is probably pretty much on the same lines. In fact, I used, when I was teaching at A&P school, I had my old notes from Northrop, and I used them for a lot of guidance to do this. Then we had a curriculum written up, too. So it worked out pretty good. And when you get out of the school, you've basically got a license, and then you go learn your trade. It's like a lot of them. But you got the groundwork. There was always a lot of, at Ween's in the coffee shop, discussion about a guy that had worked 3 years at Ween's, then he got went over and got his licenses and carried on, or somebody that had been to school. And I always took the principle, I says, yeah, it's fine, it works both ways, but the guy that's been to school has got more groundwork in the theory and the whys and the what fors instead of just go fix it and get squared away. Plus, you're limited in the types of airplanes when you're working for these outfits, too. I know people around here only worked on one type of airplane, and yet they've got their licenses. So, I when it comes down to it, I'd rather have a guy that had been to school. But Terry's an exception. He was at the A&P school, then he worked a bit in aircraft, then he went 302. He worked for about, I don't know how many years. He retired out in his 50s. Came over here and said he'd like to work on airplanes again. Well, he had a lot of the basics, and he's a damn good mechanic, and it worked out fine. Normally, I can't afford to hire somebody right out of school. I have to spend too much time with them. And you can't charge a customer for all of that. So basically, you got two guys working, getting one man's wages. So it's to go to work for a larger outfit for a while, get experience, and then go off on what you're going to do. It's about the way it's good. Basically, the way it works out.
What aircraft were you working on when you were working for Wing?
Oh, my. Then they had a DC-4 and 46s and 3s and Cessnas, Beavers. But I was basically, because of my background, I was doing the fabric work. There was a little shop out back of the hangar, and I was out there for a couple of years and just recovering surfaces. Remember the 46 and the 3, the DC-4? And even the Constellation they had fabric control services. And the Beechcraft had twin beaches also. So I'm doing something one day, and I went out with the lead man, and I said, somebody, what all this? Christ, you know, this junk laying around here, it's getting destroyed. You know, control services. And they didn't have a fabric man. He'd left, old timer, name of Rasmussen. And the guy said, "Will you do this?" "Oh, hell yes." So I ended up in the fabric shop at my own little place. And time went by, and then there was a... God, I'd been building a house, and I was kind of broke, and everything was screwed up. So they had an opening on the Dew Line as a mechanic. 1DC3 up based at Barter Island. And I put in for that. And lo and behold, they said, "Go for it." And it was perfect for me. Like I said, I was broker in hell. So that had free room and board and all the overtime you had to put in. And when working alone, of course, and flying every day too, I was also the flight attendant. So I stayed up there for about a year until I got all refinanced out of debt and squared away, and then I came back to town. But yeah, that was an interesting one. That was good. Flew 6 days a week. Worked on the airplane in the off times and at nights. And Sundays until the FAA showed up and said, "You can't do that. You have to have one day off." I said, "Oh, okay, that's fine." So I worked Sundays and put the time on the other days. Everybody was happy. Yeah, we flew a lot. Part of this one summer. It was about a year. And the pilots timed out. Normally it was 80 hours. They'd gone to 100, which was their maximum for overtime. So they sent up another flight crew. And I'm screaming, "Well, wait a minute, I'm flight crew too. Take me to town, you know. I want to get to town." I only came in about every 2 months for 2-3 days and went back up again. And I was getting a little tired of this. Anyhow, no, you got to stay. You ain't got nobody else. I think that 1 month must have got 150 some hours flying time plus working on the airplane. But it was a good plane. It didn't take much to keep it going. If you got on top of it, then you're all right.
Where exactly did you fly? Did you fly all the way around?
No, I went from Barter. Barter was, I guess, our main base, you'd call it. And then we flew, it'd be south. Or no, it wouldn't be. It's the other way. You went west across the coast to Barrow, and then you went south from there. So we went into Flaxman, coming on the American side, Flaxman, Oliktok, which was POW 2, Lonely was POW 1, and then Barrow, then further south to Wainwright and Point Lay. And then sometimes we'd go off the other way into Canada. We went way over there a bunch of times too. We were going across here one winter night or day. The moonlight's real sharp and great. Middle of bloody winter. And we came across seals lined up at a crack in the ice. There must have been hundreds of them. And we're just bored along. What the hell's that? So we got down pretty low. And those seals were going in the ice, in the crack in the ice as we went come across them. Just boom, 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 boom. Most fascinating thing you ever saw. No camera. Yeah. First went over to Cape Parry. I don't know what they call our station over there. A lot of times to Tuktoyaktuk. I think that's one of the outlets to the Mackenzie. It was there, yeah. The Eskimos over there, they were a little different than the ones in Alaska. I think they were more pure Eskimo. It was a little different again.
Different looking or different?
A little different looking. They were smaller, thinner, tough looking bunch. Yeah. But see, basically, we went down to the village at Tuktuk once or twice. But had to see the Hudson's Bay store and all that. But basically, stayed at the sites. Except at Barrow. You had to go into Barrow and get the mail and everything for the company. Party a bit. Yeah, it's quite a job. Had a room at Barrow and had a room at Barter. But it paid better than anything else. What with the free room and board and all. Yeah, that was an interesting one. That's where I got my DC-3 time. The guys would let me fly a little bit now and then. Yeah, some guy asked me once years later, he says, "Jesus, you ought to get your..." He was an instructor. We're talking, he says, "You ought to get your license." And I says, "Oh, Jesus, I have your flying license." I said, "I don't know what for, but whatever." He says, "Look, if you just go take the written," he says, "and I'll fix you up." Well, okay. And then he says, well, how much time you got? And I'm sitting there for a minute, and he says, do you count DC-3 time? I says, you dumb. He got up and walked out. He didn't even have DC-3 time.
When you think back of all the mechanics you've worked with, you have some that really stick out in your mind?
Oh, yeah, that old engine man, Eldred Quam, he was fantastic. Worked with Ernie Hubbard for a bit, and for airframes and stuff, he was very, oh God, he's good, but in a way, he spent so much time on detail that it was a beautiful job, but most people, it was a little high-priced, I think. Of course, since it's so far back, you could overhaul a supercar from end to end and sell it for $12,000, $13,000 and be ahead of the game. Let's see who else. My, those two stick out the best of anything. The whole crew at Fairbanks Aircraft were very, very good and real good to me, teaching me stuff. Dave Phillips was very, very good. And Joe Spiney was probably one of the better sheet metal guys. He was at Weens. Well, he worked at Fairbanks Aircraft also. Maybe it was Bachner's by then. Yeah, and he worked over there after he got out of service, and then he went on to Weens and was there for years. I think he was still pounding rivets when he's up in his 70s.
Did you happen to know the Grimans growing up here?
Oh, yeah. They lived down the street from us.
Yeah, I took heavy equipment classes from Paul Griman Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, there was an older brother, Paul. No? Which one was which? Willis was the youngest one. There was a couple of girls. Which one did you deal with?
Paul Jr.
There was an older one, too, but he died young from diabetes or leukemia or something. Oh, yeah. Their house is still on 8th Avenue. Big log place. And the story was that the old man went down there and trying to get a loan to work in his house, and they wouldn't give him any money because it was too far out of town. It was out in the outskirts. Yeah, their dad had a garage here for years, and bus service, all kinds of things. There's a big building down there on the Griman building. It's been torn down now, I think. It was abandoned for years.
Where was it, Tom?
Let me place it here. I want to say, see, it's Lacey and Noble Street. I want to say around First and Noble, right in there. Went from street to street, I think. First up to second. I think that's right.
Do you have other topics you'd like to discuss today?
Up to you.
I think I'll wrap it up for today. I spent all night at work puking from my neck.
Oh, Jesus.
So I'm a little on the burned out side.
Yeah.
I'll play with these a little bit, and I'm sure I'm going to have more things I'd like to talk to you about when it's a good time for you.
Well, there's no problem with that. And we can get back in the office if it's during the week or something. And I've got these three I picked up, and there's a couple more albums of wrecked airplanes and other odds and ends.
Yeah, when there'd be a good time for you to, I'd like to, if I could take some of those pictures and scan them, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, no, I also got one carousel of slides that's basically all wrecked airplanes.
I would go talk to, I don't know how to deal with slides. I'd like to go talk to the people at the archives.
I see.
University and see if they have they make things that you can make prints off of slides.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see here. I'll have to just check and see which one of these you'd like to take. Do you want to take one with you now, or? And we'll get back together, say, next week sometime?
Yeah. I can get started on scanning them. and then I can bring you a disc, like a copy of the disc I make with all the pictures on it.
Oh.
I have it on CD.
Oh, okay.
Do you have a computer here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it have internet?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometime, not today, because I'm right on the verge of getting sick again. Let me see. I want to be sure I saved this right.
Jesus, speaking of, oh yeah, wrecked airplane, forgot. A C-46 at the mountainside out of Livengood. It's been bellied in. A wrecked single otter on the no attack.
What kind of thing was it that caught fire on Georgia up in Chandler Lake?